Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, joined alongside me, Whitney Wright. Whitney, welcome back to another fun, exciting week in the world of publishing.
Yes, you were just saying you made sure that you had some good kicks on for the day. What are they?
These are the Deconstruct Nike Dunks. So, yeah.
Never heard of them. I'm sure they're... I don't keep up on my Nike, like, what's coming out next and stuff.
It's funny. I never did until a couple of years ago. It was something where it's like, if you would have known me maybe a decade ago, I would have been that guy that wore the same shoes for a year and then got a new pair of shoes and had one pair. But yeah, later on in life, I've learned to appreciate the shoe thing. I never thought it was all that important. It's like, it's on your feet, you know? People don't look at your feet very often, do they? So, least important clothes.
At least you're not like my dad, who finds a pair of shoes, and if he likes them, he buys like three pairs because he's going to go through them, and he still wants to keep them, even if they're falling apart. So he'll just put on the next pair after that.
Yeah. I actually was that person when I was in high school, I think. Ugh. I had like so many pairs of the Adidas, the ones with the shell, the Superstars or whatever.
Oh, yeah. You're like, I love this shoe. If it goes, they stop selling it, what am I going to do?
I know. They never will. Adidas is like addicted to that shoe.
It's tried and true. Well, for topics today, I wanted to chat a little bit about, I saw that Twitter blocked links to Threads, so like on Twitter, you know, so I thought that'd be kind of interesting to just touch on for a second. And then the EU signs a transatlantic data deal and how you shouldn't rely on LLMs to do your SEO. And then a new Core Web Vitals update coming about they're getting rid of first input delay and they're swapping it out with something else. So just to start, have you seen this, like, have you seen what Elon Musk has been posting about Threads? He's not happy.
Yeah. I mean, you know what
Which makes sense.
You know what I can appreciate about it is that, you know, a lot of the platforms, they've done these very shrouded and sort of passive aggressive and very subtle ways of trying to basically like trying to cut each other off. And really there's a certain extent there where it's like, that's the sort of like, that's why many of them are in hot water over monopolies is like, they under the guise of something like privacy, they find ways to try to like cut each other off at the pass. I kind of appreciate a more straightforward one where it's like, they just block the links and then just talk trash to each other. Like I prefer that
on their own like, respective platform.
Yeah. Don't lie to me and tell me it's about privacy so that you can like, you know, keep somebody from making, you know, all of their money in a product or an app or something and taking 30%. I kind of like it just being straightforward. Just let me know what I'm dealing with here.
Yeah, exactly. I also think it's just kind of interesting. It went from this like kind of playful banter of like, we're going to be in a fight. And then they release Threads and he's like, oh, I actually do hate you though.
Yeah. I mean, the fight thing. We talked about it a little bit last week, but yeah, I mean, I think the mistake on Elon's part is, you know, there was something they used to always talk about when I was in school. I had to take a radio class and they would say that like the shock jocks or like the radio morning DJs was always really competitive and they were always rotating different, people through. They'd rotate in, whatever popular show was in syndicate. And the number one thing you would do if you were in a new market, they would say, is that you had to call out the other show, the other ones in the market. And what would happen is if they took the bait, then all of a sudden, the most popular show is talking about this new show in town. And so then people want to check it out. And I sort of think about this in the same way where it's like, you know, you're doing them a big service by telling and talking about this thing that's they're calling a Twitter rival or whatever. I mean, it's piggybacking off of just Instagram. So it's like they're going to cannibalize most of their own users to do this thing. It's when you download the app, you only have one option. It's like it's like Threads by Instagram and then one click and you've quote unquote created an account. And like you brought up last week, you can only delete it if, you know, you delete your Instagram account. So their numbers and popularity they're kind of fake. And on top of that, it's like all their success is going to depend on new users, which Twitter seems to have you know, maybe some unique ones. So I don't know why he would want to talk about it so much.
I don't either. Yeah, I saw that it's like the fastest social media like growth, like for a new app ever. But like you said, it's like tied in with Instagram. So it's kind of.
Yeah, the way that they should measure it is they should say how many that aren't also Instagram users or haven't logged in the last month even. And I bet the number shrinks by like 90%.
Yeah, definitely. So we were just talking about data last week with, I think it was Sweden was, you know, saying that there's some GDPR problems with, Google Analytics, but now there's this, the European Union has restored a decision that allows for transatlantic data exchanges between the US, the EU, and this has been a 3-year stalemate apparently. So this just allows data to move between the two regions, and it recognizes law reforms in the U.S. that would offer sufficient protection for Europeans' data. Like, you know, we talked about last week there, a little bit, keep it close to their chest. They don't trust completely the U.S.'s policies on data, that we're not as strict as they are. So this seems to be a, like I was saying, like a stalemate that's finally kind of ending. But apparently
this is why Threads didn't launch in Ireland, they were saying, is partially.
Yeah, yeah. They're still working this out. I think there's an Austrian activist that's wants to challenge the new deal, though. So not everyone's going to be happy, of course. But what does this look like in publishing as far as like data moving back and forth? Was this, I guess, if you know some of the history behind the stalemate, you're a little bit more involved in the news back 3 years ago when this was first starting than I was. And now that I'm on the podcast, obviously, I'm a little bit more in tune, but...
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with this is I don't think it's meaningful for publishers outside of they just have to wait to see if there's anything in terms of the regulations, that especially those that are in the EU regarding how they have to, you know, message their consent and things like that. The biggest thing is, and I'm going to preface this by saying I'm not an attorney, so this is just my these are my opinions and thoughts. Don't take it as legal advice. But most publishers are not targeted in any of these legislations. Now, that doesn't mean that they're directly affected and maybe the most affected by the actual actions needed. But realistically, the gun's not pointed at you. And I think that the way to look at that is basically like, what are the bare minimum hoops that I'm gonna have to jump through? It's kind of the, you don't have to outrun the bear, you just have to outrun the slowest person. It's running from the bear. And I sort of like think about this the same way with GDPR. To actually fulfill the requirements of GDPR, it was originally written, I think is almost no one is actually doing. Maybe now things have changed. It's been a minute since I've looked through all the different updates. But yeah, I think almost everybody sort of fulfills these bare minimum requirements that have been established throughout most like different types of sites that are out there. And that'll pretty much keep you safe from anything that's that effective. Now, that being said, this is really not that big of a deal from the standpoint of what this is like tariffs for digital like products and goods, because we never really had this before. I mean, in the 2000s, whenever, you know, Google was releasing Gmail and, you know, you had things like Chrome and all these different types of free, you know, internet technologies. It took a long time for both regulators and the population to realize like, oh, these things aren't free. We're the product. It's the data being sold.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, if you're, you know, the EU or just about any country, you go, well, wait a minute, like we're exporting like all these products for no cost to America. And I think that that's one of the things that you're seeing a lot more of these take place now. And I think that that's one of the big contentions actually in trade with the US and China, although it's not discussed very often.
Yeah, it seems like one of those things where it's like, let the big kids kind of fight amongst themselves and keep doing what you're doing. And whatever the answer is that you have to know in the end will come out, and then it'll probably change anyway. So
yeah, I really do think that this is probably just, you know, this is inside baseball for me type stuff, because I don't think that I don't think it's going to affect publishers in a meaningful sense, at least directly for maybe a while.
Yeah. Well, back to AI. This is from Search Engine Land, and it is kind of a cautionary tale of using something like ChatGPT to do your SEO for you. You know, we have talked constantly of what AI is capable of or what it should be used for versus like what it shouldn't be used for. And SEO is just not something that it should be used for. One, isn't it only updated on information up to like September 2021?
Well, there's, I mean, so like, you know, large language models was the term that you had mentioned originally. So large language models could be a lot of things, but ChatGPT specifically is only up to 2021. But if you want updated information, there's all kinds of plugins and different types of, you know, layers and stuff like that that'll allow you to do that. And I'd argue that it can do SEO. It's just, it can do SEO the same way a brilliant like 14-year-old that's never done it before could do it if they worked for you.
Right, exactly.
They'd have to like learn what you're trying to do.
Right. And so this was just saying, you know, like, there's all these things of like all the things that LLMs can do, it can pass exams and, you know, replace human intelligence, but it's often exaggerated. So it went through three different cases of when it was trying to perform like a human feat, such as an MIT, there's an MIT study that it was writing a paper or something and, you know, there was plagiarism. And then the second case was it was handling math and it was relying more on pattern recognition than actually understanding math, obviously. And then the third case study was its performance in riddles demonstrates its limitations in contextual understanding and independent problem solving. So, which is a lot of what SEO is doing. You're like analyzing data and figuring out your next step should be, which it can do, but it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it doesn't understand the context of your website and like what all the things, like the background and the history that you know about it. And I think that publishers should be reminded that it lacks true intelligence. And so using it as an SEO tool is helpful, but it shouldn't be like your new SEO expert.
Yeah, I it's definitely not an expert. So one of the main differences between machine learning and neurons in the brain. And this is, I'm going to steal this from our good friend, Dr. Greg Sirk, who actually was like a neuroscientist for a while. Cause, I remember him explaining, a lot of this and then I parroted it as I do. And one of the things that I remember him like really harping on was, so like a neuron operates very similar to the way that you would sort of visualize machine learning, and you have like one bubble. So you can just kind of, that's like one neuron, one bubble. It's like a brand new one, fresh out of the box. It's learned nothing. And then the second it starts to learn the difference between, let's say, you know, red and blue, it distinguishes one. And it's like, all right, well, that's red. So it knows what red looks like. And then there's blue. So now it knows what blue looks like. It splits in half. Now you have two bubbles. But now then you introduce green. So now it's got three bubbles. And a neuron just sort of has these like dendrites that stick out from it. So you can imagine bubbles like kind of like with these little suction cups that reach out and touch the other one. And over time, it's like when you start to get more and more complex information coming in, those dendrites start connecting to each other slowly but surely. And they sort of like, you can kind of imagine these big like globs of like little bubbles that some of them are moving like together and bunching up and making bigger bubbles. And then some of them are moving further apart. And then some of them have connections and others don't. This is how your brain naturally is sort of making connections and like weighting the importance of different information. The machines are working in an extremely similar way. The only problem is that humans have like a four-dimensional or three-dimensional like input data, meaning like there's all these other signals and things like that you can pick up on. The machines don't. And because of that, even with the best semantic language knowledge, you think about even with language, how much of when you're talking to somebody are you actually trying to communicate versus we always know about nonverbal communication, but think about like whenever I'm having a conversation with somebody and maybe I'm explaining, you know, a funny story or I'm asking them about where they grew up. I might not actually be trying to learn that information. I may be trying to present to them something about myself that will change the way that they would respond. Meaning maybe I want them to think I'm smart. Maybe I want them to think I'm from a rural area too. So maybe they'll be more comfortable with me. These things change the way that the person responds to me. And so mm-hmm. with that in context, to be able to understand, you know, what somebody is searching for on the internet, like what is the nature of their query? You know, Google struggled with this for the longest time. It's why the algorithm changes. Mm-hmm. It's not just to try to circumvent bad actors. And I think, you know, with that in mind, it can do things, but you have to give it the specific instruction and the right sort of problem to solve. I think asking it to do SEO is like asking, you know, a baby to do it. It's like it could do it eventually, but like you're gonna have to let it grow up first.
Yeah, definitely. I think it can be helpful in kind of thinking of maybe next steps for, you know, if you want to try something new in SEO, but like you said, like it doesn't understand context or, you know, user intent. And I think that this is where humans come into like such an important role is like you were saying, like, let's pretend you have a website on where did you grow up? What was the town called?
Montgomery City, Missouri.
Montgomery City. So let's say like, you know, you have a website on places to visit in Montgomery City.
Missouri. There are none. Already, if you're a publisher out there, that site can just be burned.
Don't try to make that website because it's not going anywhere. But you as an insider would know way more about like what people from Montgomery City would want to probably know and look up. Oh, man, versus like
I'm going to put that as my profile tag now. Montgomery City Insider.
But as an insider and like as someone who's lived there and grew up there, like you have better context of what someone in Montgomery City might be looking for on a website about Montgomery City versus if you just throw it out to AI and you're like, what would someone from Montgomery City, Missouri like to look up? And like it's going to give you a bunch of like probably popular places that people
go. He's an imposter. Get him. He's a robot. They would know immediately.
Yeah, exactly. They would. But yeah, like you understand the people that are using this website versus like AI and even Google can only kind of gather information and guess at what these people are really trying to get to. Maybe that's a bad example.
It's a good one. And I think we mentioned it last week too, where it's like, you know, I think don't get confused what these things are for. These things are tools. So it can help you do everything much faster. And it doesn't mean it can't do the jobs that you're doing today, but the value that humans provide in publishing is the humanness. It's the knowledge, the information, the specialized skills, talents, experiences that you have. Machines don't have that. That should be where you spend your time is conveying mm-hmm. and, you know, like basically inputting that information into machines in different ways. And then like, let it write content, let it, you know, figure out like, it can even do SEO. The thing is like you have to tell it what to do. And I think expecting it to do it for you is probably already a recipe for disaster in the same way that asking it to just build and run your website for you while you go to the beach is probably not going to be effective or all that. Yeah. Relevant here for at least the short term.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll see what they come up with in the next 10 years. Maybe you will be able to build your own website and go to the beach.
Maybe we will be our own website. I don't even know what that means.
Maybe.
Hey, my name is Terrence, business intelligence analyst here at Azoic. Want to get the best insights with your website to maximize your revenue? Azoic Ads with Big Data Analytics is your answer to that question. Did you know publishers that spend at least 2 hours in our Big Data Analytics earn, on average, 10 times more than publishers that have never used it before? With our analytics, tie revenue to everything, whether it be SEO insights, best performance of your authors, the location of your users, and much more. Look at your data like you never have before. Check out more information in the description below and try Big Data Analytics in your Azoic account today.
So our last topic here is that Google Search Console is notifying about IMP Core Web Vitals issues. So Google started sending out email notifications about the new, it's called Interaction to Next Core Web Vitals Report. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it's replacing FID, which is First Input Delay. And starting March of next year, it will be a Core Web Vital, one of the three that you should try to, you know, optimize for. So it's measuring site responsiveness, and it represents a page's overall interaction latency and is calculated based on the longest interactions or the 98th percentile of interaction latency. And so, like I said, it'll show up later this year, and it will stop showing FID metrics when it replaces it officially in March 2024. And already Search Console has detected INP issues for multiple properties. So they're giving you a little bit of a heads up, you know, giving you some time before it fully takes over.
I got notifications on a bunch of sites yesterday. So they are showing up now in the, I think, Search Console.
What can you explain what like interaction latency, or like what is the 98th percentile of interaction latency?
No, I can't explain it because it's all these things are so interaction latency. So all these things that they keep kind of making up, they just sort of change an existing definition of an existing acronym. Mm-hmm. So like for the longest time, DOM is the sort of like, it's where something renders. So a browser just shows HTML. So if you've ever heard of JavaScript or CSS or any of these other programming languages, if they're used in something that's going to have to display in a browser like a website, it has to render someplace. And the best way to do that in cases of JavaScript or something like that is you have what's called a virtual DOM. It's basically like a, you can imagine it's like in monitor in the cloud where basically what's going to show on the user screen has to show up there first, and it can actually render these other languages and then sends it to the browser. And the problem with that is that when you have lots of external JavaScript, like you got a Google Analytics tag and you've got, you know, different things like that, a Google Analytics tag is not HTML in most cases, the G tag event. But the thing with that is it has to register as HTML or it has to do something. And so all of those things basically like delay until the user is going to see what's on the screen. So for the longest time, all these different acronyms all were essentially trying to get at that. And measuring just that alone is kind of like a misnomer because it's like, well, what if it loads, but like none of the content's there for an hour and a half? It's like, well, that's bad. People don't like that. But all these things are just passive aggressive ways of trying to figure out whether or not, you know, is the site fast enough for users? I mean, we should really step back and ask ourselves what the motivation is with this, because Google's not using it as a ranking factor. They're just not. Like, we've looked at the data a billion times over. Like, where are the bodies? Where's the sites that have seen their traffic increase substantially from making it faster? And I mean objective, real data where you can point to that being something that contributed. I've yet to see it, and I've worked in this space for a very long time. That said, if we want to measure your user experience, why don't we do that? I mean, Google does do that in different ways. They know what different categories, and queries are, you know, they know how long people are going on the page. They know if they're bouncing back to the SERP. They understand what a good result and a bad result is based on objective, like, user data. But why is speed something that matters to that, if that's the whole point of it? And the answer is it doesn't. Speed is it's Google's weapon against Apple, because if everybody on a mobile device started using apps as opposed to web browsers, Google's business would go away. And their concern with, you know, the app experience and how it's superior is how much faster and just more native it feels. And so websites taking time to load, you know, they see that as a barrier, as potentially user behavior shifting over time. So that's why speed is even a thing. And that's today's lesson on things that suck from big tech.
Well, was there anything else? I haven't seen anything else on this. Was there anything else that you saw on it, or anything else that we talked about or you saw in the news that was worth mentioning?
You know, we talked about the thread things earlier, and I kind of went on my little diatribe there, but I don't think so. I think we covered a lot of the different things that are out there right now. And I would just say, like, I feel like this is like a very strong, or I was very cynical in this podcast. And so I would encourage everyone and also just probably, I'll speak out of both sides of my mouth here. I would say I would encourage you to be not as cynical as I am. I've been in this space and been doing this stuff a long time. And so I sort of look at every party in the space is sort of like nothing is altruistic and like very agenda driven. But that being said, I do think that this is a time where things will change and things can change. And I think it's important to be able to be flexible in your thinking and sort of like open your mind up, because I think where I see different, some of the larger, more incumbent parties in this space falling short right now is I think they're very much stuck in the way that things used to be. And I think a lot of times cynicism can work against you in that regard. And so I'm trying to be more open-minded about seeing the best in all the different players in the ecosystem. So hopefully, audience, you will too. But that's it from me, Whitney.
All right. Well, you can find us at publisherlab.org. You can drop us a line there of anything you want us to talk about, or, you know, leave us a comment, a suggestion. You can find all the podcast episodes on there or wherever you find podcasts. You can watch this on YouTube. We have a Publisher Lab playlist that you can watch all of our episodes if you prefer to do that. You can leave us a comment on there, like and subscribe, leave us a rating on wherever you find podcasts. And this has been another episode of the Publisher Lab.